beckoning behind them, toward the distant blur of the Institute.
I trade for it, John. Like everything else.
The armorer glanced across at Ryan, who was sitting on the starboard side between Christie and his son. They'd talked briefly the previous night about this trading, trying to work out just what it was that Tomlin had to offer that was so valuable to the inhabitants of the scattered bills to the north. And nobody had been able to come up with a satisfactory answer to the question. The engine, combined with the rushing wind and the kick of the boat against the choppy swell, made conversation impossible, and JB didn't bother to pursue the subject of the trading.
Good, clean air.
The man who spoke, named Thorend, was one of the older men from the Institute. He had a long, thin face, rather like a bewildered sheep, with a short-cropped thatch of thinning hair. His eyes were a piercing blue.
Not so clean as when we started off first thing this morning. Sulfur. You smell it, John?
What? I can't hear you over the engine noise.
I said I could smell sulfur.
Yeah, something.
Like eggy farts. It's coming from over that way.
They all followed Dean's eager pointing finger toward the northeast.
There's a cloud there, right down near the surface of the Atlantic.
Yellow cloud.
Ryan moved carefully toward the stern of the boat, attracting the attention of Tomlin.
Look over that way.
The professor nodded, the sunlight flashing off his spectacles.
We get plenty of them, Ryan. There are still all manner of undersea explosions and movements of the tectonic plates. Don't worry about the scientific details. All seismological. A bit beyond you, I expect.
Like a volcano?
Possibly. No danger.
What if we get closer to it?
What? You want us to get closer to it?
No, but what if we did?
Ah, reading you scale 10 now. Well, it would be a little like standing on top of a volcano as the vent blows and the magma strikes the fan.
I've seen eruptions.
Indeed?
Yeah.
Yet you've lived to tell about it, so it obviously isn't too fearful.
But Tomlin adjusted the boat's course slightly closer to land, easing back on the throttle to slow its progress, keeping it at a safe distance from the menacing cloud. They ran into a school of striped mullet. The boat seemed to be almost floating in a torrent of the silvery fish. Fishing lines were unnecessary, and everyone lent a hand in scooping them out by the dozen in the long-handled nets. A cascade of flailing, gasping mullet covered the bottom boards of the small vessel.
It's like they're crazed.
Chuck Cebulski, one of Tomlin's crew, struggled to heft a loaded net over the side, grinning at Dean as the boy slithered across the mound of dying fish to help him with the catch. The torrent of blue-striped fish was racing all around them, seeming to be heading in a southerly direction.
Think there's some sharks after them, or a great whale?
I can assure you categorically that there are neither dangerous sharks nor any threatening whales in this sector of the ocean.
How do you know?
I know, therefore I know. Surely, as a man of science, you're familiar with Lobkowitz's first principle of certainty, Tanner?
I can't say that I'm familiar either with the gentleman or with his work.
He's probably one of the newer fellows, Doc.
Perhaps.
The surging flood of mullet ceased as suddenly as it had started.
There was a great stillness that lay between heaven and earth. I rather suspect that someone must have opened the seventh seal and let loose the dogs of war and cried out for havoc and... Upon my soul, but I fear that I have again lost the thread of what I was saying.
It is quiet. Where's the dolphin escort, Professor?
Escort? I haven't spotted any dolphins escorting us.
You wouldn't, not unless they want you to see them.
But you knew they were here?
Of course.
So where are they now?
Miranda looked at Tomlin, as though she were waiting for permission to answer the question. When he showed no reaction, she shook her head.
Don't know. I picked up interest, fear, and quick move talk. Then nothing. If I had my equipment here, I could monitor them, even if they're miles away from us.
Where isn't the question. Why is much more the point.
They're amazingly sensitive to all sorts of natural phenomena.
Mildred had been sitting with her boots among the megacola fish, her right hand trailing idly over the side of the boat. She suddenly pulled it out.
This water's fucking... pardon my language, but it's really hot.
Wow, like boiling soup, Dad.
And I can smell sulfur again.
Christy leaned over and stared down into the deeps around them, shading her eyes to try to pierce the mirrored surface.
Look, I see bubbles!
Tomlin spun like a dervish and tried to get the outboard engine started, winding the strip of cord and jerking at it. Nothing. He tried a second time with an equal lack of success. His glasses hung crooked, His eyes were open so wide that blank white showed all around the irises.
It's really starting to boil.
There had once been a long conversation, stretching out over several evening camps, about the nature of death and near-death experiences. Conversation that sometimes veered toward argument. Argument that sometimes flirted with the skirts of bitter violence. Ryan remembered that Huneker, the green-haired bisexual driver of Warwag 1, had gone after Laws the cook with a lean-bladed flensing knife. Trader had stopped her by cracking the butt of his beloved battered Armalite against the side of her skull, laying her out flat cold. The point that had produced such bitter anger was whether your whole life really did flash by you at the moment of your death. Laws had insisted that he'd met a gaudy once who nearly died when a bondage game with a John went wrong. She swore that she saw every single second of her 13 years as the rope tightened inexorably around her throat. Hun had suggested that she was overloaded on jolt at the time. Ryan had been surprised that almost all of the crew had some story or other about hearing their long-dead mother speak to them as they were about to set their foot on an implode grin, or seeing themselves as little babies in a dream, and the next day they were nearly fragged in a mutie raid. Ryan himself had been finger-whipped close to death on a number of occasions. One fine summer's day, when he'd been just 18, he'd been walking across a flower-decked meadow in New England, without a care in the world. He'd spent a few days working for a farmer, and enjoying the farmer's daughter at night. Now he was on his way, seeking fresh fields and new adventures, chewing on a tender stalk of green grass. The very next splinter of recorded time saw him flat on his back in the dirt, staring up at the sky, with no sense at all of what could have happened. There'd been no sound and no feeling of any impact. The bullet had struck him just above the right ear, glancing off at an angle into a shrub oak by a nearby stream. His luck was that the murderous farmer owned only an antique smoothbore black powder musket and was using it at extreme range, actually firing from the bedroom window of his weeping 30-year-old daughter. But Ryan was definitely certain that nothing in his past life had flashed before him at that moment. In his present situation, all he remembered, as he was sucked deep under the surface, was the foul stink of chemicals and the intolerable heat of the Atlantic Ocean. His hand had reached out for balance toward Christy, and their fingers had brushed. Now it was dark. Despite the monstrous horror of his predicament, Ryan managed to hang on to some shreds of sense. He realized that there must have been a gigantic underwater explosion, probably volcanic in origin. The pale yellow cloud in the distance, the clogging stink of sulfur, the fleeing shoal of striped mullet, the unnatural stillness of the moment, then the heat and the bubbling. Knowing what was killing him didn't seem that much of a consolation. His legs kicked and his fingers clawed at the water. The eruption had brought up so much primeval mud from the bottom of the ocean that it had turned day into pitchy night, making it almost impossible to distinguish up from down. And there was enormous pressure all around him, mocking his feeble efforts to try to swim to safety. All his senses were starting to slip uncontrollably away from him. His skin was tender, feeling loose on his body, and both his good eye and the raw puckered socket were stinging as if someone had sprayed acid in them. His breath was rapidly vanishing from his lungs. Ryan probably slipped from consciousness, though he had no sentient awareness of any change. The darkness and the suffocating oppression didn't alter at all. He drew a great roaring gasp of air into his chest, his arms flung high toward the ochre sky. Though he just hovered on the brink of the drowning abyss, his fighting reflexes quickly reasserted themselves. He sank again for a moment, swallowing a sickening gulp of foul salt water. Then his legs kicked and his arms flailed, and he was swimming once more, trying to direct himself away from what seemed the core of a massive undersea explosion. The ocean was in turmoil. The eruption had somehow affected the weather, and the fine morning had gone, replaced by leaden clouds and crackling bolts of purple lightning that tore the sky apart. The waves all around him were massive, gray-green mountains that fell roiling into the next swell, white-topped and menacing. Ryan kept finding himself in the trough, unable to see more than a few yards in any direction, unable to see what had happened to the boat. Worse, unable to see in what direction the land might lie. He could make out where the center of the disturbance lay, about 100 yards ahead of him, where a column of steam, smoke, and liquid mud was hurled into the air, tinted a dark yellow-orange color. Ryan's luck lay in the eruption hurling him away from its murderous